Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roering, Simon Schuster, Jacob Kanzler, and our special guest this week, we got from Vanguard Public Affairs, TJ Buchholz and Jen Iyer.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm well.
Good morning.
All right, so we're going to do some round-robin questions, and since we have just kicked off basically the summer session here and we have transitioned away from legislation to general prognostication, let's start with this great piece of prognostication. The Democrats' next gubernatorial nominee will be.
That is a dicey game this far out still.
I know. That's why I asked it.
This
is the conversation starter.
You know, I say a lot that it's light years until August. And every cycle, it seems like we get out front earlier and earlier and earlier. You know, Gretchen Whitmer, obviously, I would say the prohibitive front runner at this point. But I think you've got a lot of people out there who are interested in making some noise and interested in getting in the race. I don't think it's just going to be her at the end of the day.
No, I think what we're waiting for right now is that July 20th deadline, the filing deadline for the first round of campaign finance. And I think we've got some candidates who are waiting in the wings, at least one that I can think of, to see how that's going to go for Gretchen Whitmer and to see where she stands and where the other declared candidates stand and take it from there.
All right. So I think you're probably talking about Mark Murdenstein. Is Mark Bernstein going to get in? Am I right? I mean, because if Bernstein doesn't get in, is there anyone standing in the way between Gretchen Whitmer and the nomination?
Again, I think Jen's point is really valid, which is I think you've got a couple different folks. Mark Bernstein probably being one, Mark Hackle being another. You know, I still keep hearing Mike Duggan in for things. Being out front early has advantages and disadvantages. And the disadvantage really is this deadline that Jen's talking about from a certain point, because money indicates strength, and that's sad to me sometimes, but it's true. And I think people are going to be looking to see not just where Gretchen is on the scope of raising money, but who contributed, where those contributions came from, who's all in with her, and who's sort of holding back. I think people are going to be interested in that, and it sort of portends what might be to come.
We should note, though, that these two of her opponents, if they get in, really won't have to worry about fundraising per se.
You know,
and you're talking about Figer and Bernstein, right? Yeah. So
you're talking about self-funding, really. And you know, and I know Mark Bernstein, I know Jeff Figer a little, and you know, I just sometimes I feel like the notion of the Democratic Party is if you have some money in your pocket, that you're automatically a self-funder. The magnitude of money that you need today to win the governor's race, it doesn't mean that if you've got some money in your pocket that you're going to put all of it into that. I think it's unfair sometimes to say, well, and I think that to John's point, there are some people in this party, in the Democratic Party, who say, well, we've got a self-funding candidate, so we're going to check the box and put our resources elsewhere. I don't think that that's fair, especially to a Mark Bernstein, you know, to expect that he spend his, you know, his fortune on it. I think that you've got to still have other resources and other groups in with you. I don't think it's fair to just say you're a self-funder.
Yeah, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars, obviously, and I don't. You know, we saw Dick DeVos do that years ago, but I don't think that a Mark Bernstein or possibly even a Jeff Figer is going to donate that level of resources to a gubernatorial campaign.
Let's start putting some odds to the chances that these folks who we've just mentioned actually get into the race, okay? So 50% shot, 70% shot, 10% shot these people get in. Give me a number, Jen. Mark Bernstein's getting into the race. I'll start it off. I say 90%.
I'm going to go 95.
I'll say 92.5.
Simon, what do you think?
I'd say 85%.
Jacob?
Yeah, it's anything north of 75%.
Let's say Mike Duggan. Jen? I'll start it off again. 5%.
50%.
Whoa.
40.
I'd say 30.
Yeah, like 10%.
35.
All right. You said 50. Why, Jen? And you're smiling about it. Do you know something that we don't?
Look, I just think that he's got time. I think he's got time to see how the field shakes out. I think that there would be a lot of Democrats who would be really, really excited about a Mike Duggan candidacy.
I think some of us based our numbers off of Mike Duggan's been very candid about saying he does not want to run. So if he were to run, how would he kind of explain himself? I feel like he's very candid. And for us reporting on him, I think we go off what he says. So I guess kind of from your guys' perspective, you know, how would he kind of explain himself out of this repeated emphasis that he wouldn't run.
The July 20th deadline is a good pivot point for messaging, which is, you know, a guy like Duggan can be looking and he can look at the fundraising. He can say, it's not what they need to do, and I need to jump in and rescue the party, or I need to come in and really make a case. I think that they're, as Jen said, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, but they're light years until the primary. There's plenty of time for him to sit back and to look and see how people are doing, and if he senses weakness, to get in.
And if he does really well, I suppose, in the mayoral race, if he beats Coleman Young by a substantial amount, I guess that's possible. I'm not going to change, so I'm still going to say 5%. Okay, Mark Hackle. I'm going to start off at 1%.
30.
15.
5.
20.
I agree with Simon, 20.
Yeah, we're not very... maybe the reason that I'm a little down on Hackle at the 1% is I think we've seen this play before, haven't we?
Well, I mean, Mark Hackle is a very moderate Democrat, and is the first to tell you that. I mean, I spent some time with him on Mackinac Island talking about, you know, his future and what he wants to do, and I think he's not ruling it out, but it struck me at the end of the conversation that it was just, you know, wanting some his name out there, wanting to be considered as a player, and I think people do consider him a player. The question is, if he decides to get in, what is his pathway to the nomination? And it is not a traditional, you know, labor friendly, you know, progressive way to get there. It's reminiscent of Andy Dillon in 10, of which a campaign I worked on. So it's an interesting pathway.
And one that didn't work out for Dillon, but...
Did not work out.
Why did you rank him so low, Jen?
Well, I ranked him low, but the highest, I think, of any of us. And I would say that's because I've spoken with people who are close to him, and they insist he's absolutely serious about considering it this time. So it's a possibility. But as TJ said, It could be a tough primary row for him to hoe. So,
and I also think, just to add on to that, that, you know, over the course of the last several years, you know, Mark Hackle, I think privately and not so privately, has been looking for, you know, a running mate to help balance his more moderate tendencies. I think he's been looking for a female, high-profile female. I know he's talked to, you know, a dozen different very good high-profile women, which to maybe run as a joint platform on, and that's Republicans and Democrats alike. And we've probably heard that, Kyle. I mean, I don't think that's a big secret.
Moving on, Jeffrey Figer. I'm going to say 10%.
2%.
0.0%.
The chances of getting in, 15.
1%.
10.
Is there anything to expound on this here other than Jeffrey Figer's about Jeffrey Figer?
Well, look, I mean, first of all, his profile, his persona, we know he does this every single time, right? Now, that said, the way he speaks lately is a little bit different than it has been in the past. I almost fell out of my chair when I saw him on Off the Record, acknowledging that he doesn't know everything like he used to think he did. You know, he definitely sounds like a slightly more reasonable version of himself. However, you know, these commercials that he's running, it's all about 2020. Personally, I think if he does anything, he goes for a presidential race. I think governor is below him at this point.
Abdul El-Sayed, how seriously should we be taking his candidacy, Jen?
I think he needs to be taken quite seriously. I think that he is energizing the progressive side of the party like no other candidate currently in the race. And I think, you know, I think that's really problematic for Gretchen Whitmer. Will he eventually carry the day? Probably not. But he is certainly dampening the enthusiasm for her on the progressive, on the real progressive issues. He's out there taking stands on issues that she's not taking stands on at this point. And I think that's hurting her and her profile.
You got to be impressed by what he's done so far, TJ.
You know, when he first got in, I said, you know, this would be a guy who would be excellent DHHS director or chief medical executive. But I think he's in this campaign to stay. And I think from all the rumors I've heard, his money is going to be decent on July 20th. I don't think he's going to be at the level that a Gretchen Whitmer will be at. And I don't think that should be expected. But if he's over $500,000 in that report that he's raised so far from, you know, grassroots donation, he has to be taken seriously, and I think he'll have a voice in the process.
Yeah, I think that the seriousness of his candidacy, Kyle, and I hope that Jen and TJ can speak to this, kind of really points to, when you look at where Michigan government has been, we've had a sustained minority party, we're looking into a change election, we're looking at a broad field of Democratic candidates that don't really have a centralized message other than change. And I think that that really leads an inroad for sort of, I'd say, populistic sentiments. And I don't know if, you know, like really kind of far progressivism is necessarily the Democratic Party's version of populist sentiments. But I'm curious to both of you what you think the role of these sort of inclinations that we see emerge in 2016 are going to play in this.
I'm going to broaden the topic just a little bit, and I think what Democrats need to do is figure out what the heck their message is. And, you know, this is, I'm not saying anything that all of us around the table don't already know, right? But the fact is, we have for many years run elections on this idea that we're going to try to appeal to everyone. We're going to try to appeal to the moderate Republicans and the independents and, oh, by the way, our base as well. And that just doesn't work. And what it has done is it has allowed our opponents to constantly define us rather than us defining who we are at our core. And I think we saw that in the Georgia race. I'm not going to, sit here and say that Ossoff, definitely could have won that race by any means. But if you look at the campaign that he ran, he was very milquetoast the whole way through. He didn't take a hard stand on a lot of issues, and that allowed his opponents to define him as an outsider. And, that was just further bolstered by all of the outsiders who literally came in to support his campaign.
Well, all I know is that the more I listen to Abdul al-Sayed, the more I like him, the more serious that you have to take him as a candidate, because he is impressive, TJ. I mean, he is somebody that once you listen to him a couple times, you're like, wow, this guy actually has his stuff together.
Yeah, and that's the report you get from anybody who sits with him for more than 10 minutes, is that he has a good grasp of the issues, that he understands, I think, the sort of the desire among people in the party, the looking for a real change, looking for that sort of new voice. But just to expound on what's been said, I hate an outsider running to be an insider. That is the worst kind of pandering you can get. I'm not from this place. I don't care about this place. I don't like this place, but yet I want to be a part of it and represent you here. Jen is absolutely right, which is Democrats don't have a cohesive message. We haven't for the last few cycles. All we ever seem to be about at the party level is that we are for winning and we're for the other side losing. It's enough to say, well, they're not doing it right, or they're totally doing things wrong. But we don't follow up on that, and we don't offer an alternative. We don't say, here's what we would do if we were in that position. And I think Jen used a word last week internally that I love, which is mealy-mouthed. I think that a lot of Democrats seem to be mealy-mouthed on their message in terms of what they want to accomplish. And it's just time for us to sort of take sort of the shackles off. And it's not about being right. I don't care about being right. What I care about is winning and losing. And you can look at Ossoff and you can say, oh, he ran this terrific campaign. And, oh, he really tried to appeal to his base. But the bottom line was he lost and she won. And so at the end of the day, you can talk all you want about messaging and about who said the right things and how much money was raised, but that seat is in Republican control.
I always love this conversation about the Georgia seat, because you have to remember, though, I mean, that went from a seat that was won very handily prior to this, and he got very close. It's always interesting to hear people talk about, yes, he did lose, but that was a district that the Democrats were going to always be fighting way uphill on. So, I just want to acknowledge that, because...
Well, who got closer was Archie Parnell in South Carolina. He lost by about 2,000 votes. That's it. And he had a much stronger message. He was firmly for cutting taxes for working class families, for closing corporate loopholes, those types of, and for protecting Social Security and Medicaid. You didn't hear Ossoff take a stand on any of those issues. He wouldn't say what he would do about taxes. He wouldn't say too much about his platform at all. You looked at his commercials, and it was all about working together and bipartisanship, and bringing some tech jobs to the area. That's not the kind of message that motivates people, especially people who haven't voted in the past couple of election cycles, to get out and vote. You got to have that fire in the belly. And this notion of trying to appeal to everyone just leaves you appealing to no one in particular.
So I think we firmly established that there is no cohesive message among the Democratic Party. But I think that I still want to ask again to both of you my previous question, which is there a place for populism in the Democratic platform, and what does that look like?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, if you're talking economic populism, not nationalistic populism, right? But if you're talking who is for the working class, it is absolutely the Democrats. And we just haven't talked about it. We haven't stressed that because, again, we're afraid to make our corporate donors, upset, or we're afraid to tick off the insurance companies or these other, it really is all about the donors. And so I think we need to, take a step back, figure out if this is what we stand for, then by God, let's be fearless about talking about it. Because we're not going to win elections if we keep tampering down our message.
So I would just expound on that and remind you of a quote from The Karate Kid, which is...
Ooh, I like The Karate Kid.
Right. It's just germane to this point, which is that there's a point in the early in Daniel's training where he talks about commitment to the ideals of karate. And he says, karate yes, safe. Karate no, safe. Karate guess so, squish like grape in the road. So for me, that says... You have to be all in on it. You can't just say, well, we're about some things and not about others, and we don't want to offend people. Republicans don't care if they offend you or not. Republicans have their ideology, and you either buy it or you don't buy it. And I think that Democrats have to have a much stronger message where we own who we are.
I want to ask you two pundit questions. The question's on the board. Does Trump complete his first term?
All right, so before you guys answer, this is the stuff we kick around in the meeting before we tape the podcast. We have two questions that we asked our folks, and now that you guys are studying a little bit, does Trump finish his first term, Jen Iyer?
I'm going to say no, and it's more because of what I'm seeing from him. I just think he's going to implode, you know, at some point. He just is, he's taken on this feverish pitch of stress already, and... you know, I think at some point it's just going to be too much and he's going to walk away from it.
He's going to walk away.
I think he's going to walk away.
TJ?
Yes, I think he makes it through his term. And the reason is, even if you've got evidence to impeach him, even if you've got the folks in line that say that he had some misconduct, it requires the legislature to act. And I am not sure that this GOP-controlled federal legislature is willing to put a guy with the R behind his name up against the wall. I think that they're just going to wait, going to see what happens in the midterms and sort of muddle through until the next cycle.
So, John, we've had how many people? 12 people weigh in on this, and I think it's split evenly,
it's
6-6.
Yes, it is. Got a lot of disagreement around the table, a lot of good stuff to talk about. The second question, though, is, does the part-time legislature ballot proposal being pushed by Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly make the ballot?
Not whether it passes or not, but whether the voters are going to have the option to vote yes or no on it.
I think it does make the ballot. Ultimately, you know, I think it's going to go in front of a judge, right? I think it's going to make it, and I think that I'm going to go further and say we're going to have to fight like hell, those of us who don't think this is a good idea, to make the case for why, because this is a dangerous, dangerous proposition for our government, and it's going to be very sexy for people. You know, they're going to want to vote for it. They're going to want to take the opportunity to take a whack at the legislature once again.
TJ, does it make the ballot?
Absolutely. At the end of the day, it is a red meat issue for limited government conservatives who want government out of their lives. And if they can take an opportunity to put a ding in the people in Lansing, they're going to do it. I mean, the legislature today polls somewhere around Ebola. And I think that's been a construct of decades of, you know, Republicans whacking at the process. And I think that they're getting what they want. I think Kelly sees it as an absolute opportunity to solidify his base in and around Schuette. They're going to go to the wall on it for sure.
John, you and I were in the minority on this one, but never underestimate the power of the establishment.
That's right. And I think there's already been some legal questions raised about this particular language, and we'll see what happens.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to TJ Buchholz and Jen Iyer for stopping by MERS World Headquarters. Pleasure having you here. You get to experience the whole effect. TJ, you're an experienced veteran at this.
You know, it's an amazing room, certainly amazing people at the table who really raise issues. But truly, it does, I think, raise... I think MERS is one of those organizations that can embrace long-form journalism a little more and can actually delve into the issues and not just, you know, take 30 seconds at it. And we're subscribers, and we appreciate the detail that people put into it.
Well, I appreciate that, TJ. Well, long-form journalism, well, since we got to kick out stories every day, we have no choice but to try and keep writing, so we do our best. Jen, you got to be in shock and awe. This is just such an impressive day for you. You'll never forget it, I'm sure.
Sometimes I have to pinch myself and to remember that just a year ago, I was still a journalist. Just myself. And look at me now.
I know. You've hit the big time. Vanguard and Jen Iyer, well, thank you both for coming. Simon, Jacob, and the boss, John Roering. And special thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts, and John for reminding me to do so. He is the one who signs the checks after all, so he does have to remind me of such things. Okay, until next week, I'm Kyle Moore. Take care.